Hey y'all, this is Rich Collins of Renaissance Publishing. Welcome to Mardi Gras Beyond the Beads, a series of conversations with Mardi Gras historian Errol Laborde about the history and traditions of Carnival, the greatest free show on earth.
We're talking about Mardi Gras today, and particularly one man and one family that has been so instrumental to the celebration in New Orleans. With me is Barry Kern, who is the CEO of what is known as Kern Studios, and his son Fitz is the president of Kern Studios. They do the parades and they do other festivities, and they operate Mardi Gras World. And we're going to mention some of the other things they do, like around the world. It's just incredible. So thank you for joining us, Barry. Let me ask you, just give me the big picture. I mean, of course, everybody knew about your father, but how is the whole organization? How's it organized now?
So the organization, the business, is really, it's basically very similar from a production perspective, similar to what it has always been in terms of the way that we operate to build the floats and to do the designs. I will say that we're certainly, I think we've gotten much, much better. And in fact, in my life cycle of being here and working, you know, being around this since I'm a little boy, you've seen what we've seen now. Mardi Gras has changed, but at the same time that Mardi Gras has changed, and we saw floats go from, you know, maybe 15 to 16 people on them, or even Bacchus. Even when Bacchus first came out, if you remember in 68, 20 people on a float was a huge amount of people, right?
Sure.
And now we're building floats that are 64 people is the average float size. But in, like on the big day, on Saturday before Mardi Gras, or in most of the big parades now, floats are two or three and sometimes four and five sections long. And we're gonna, you know, I think of just pre-Katrina, you probably have in the cruise that we do almost twice as many people riding as were just riding just 20 years ago in these, in the bigger cruise. And of course, the explosion of Iris and Tux. Tux now has 2,500, 2,600 members. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, remember, if you remember when we said Endymion was a super crew and they had 12 or 1,300, and now we're talking about crews with 3,600. It's just, it's kind of mind-boggling.
But that whole new generation of parades, it really started with Bacchus. That was in, 68, 69. And,
yep.
And when you talk to like Pip Brennan and the people involved with that, I mean, your dad's name is there all the time, that he was really there and he was supporting the whole thing.
There's so many great stories about that, but I will tell you that obviously, you know, the thing that, and I think everybody knows, is that, look, Mardi Gras was probably, we could all say, or certainly maybe not necessarily the celebration per se for locals, but certainly from a tourist perspective, Mardi Gras was on the, I mean, it was
getting stale.
Yeah, it was getting stale, and not only was it getting stale, you had Pip and Dick Brennan coming to sit down. You know, Larry Youngblood, the famous story, Larry Youngblood, the costumer, brings Pip and Dick Brennan to my father's office in 1968, and they said that they wanted, you know, start this parade, and at the time, they wanted to Larry Youngblood wanted to call it the Merry Men of Sherwood.
Uh-huh.
And my dad said, Pip, Dick, wait a minute, guys, you might not know this. He's like, Pip, your dad, and Dick, your brother, you know, because that was the relationship. He said, Owen Brennan Sr. and my father's father, Roy Kern, they used to recreate the Bacchus Ball in the Lions, rather not the Bacchus Ball, but the Alla Ball in the Lions Center uptown, like in 1949, 1950. They would recreate the Alla Ball and they called it Bacchus. And that's how they came with the Bacchus name, was because my dad said, well, no, guys, you guys might not know this. And he told them that story. And my dad still had the charter of Bacchus, that original Bacchus that they had, that crew. And so that's why they came up with the name Bacchus. But at that time, you had, what, 5,000 or 6,000 hotel rooms in the city, and occupancy had gone down to 40%. And if you think about it, like, Ed Muniz came in on Saturday night to think that there was nothing on Saturday, and then even nothing on Sunday night And if you talk to anybody today and you tell them that there weren't parades or nothing, it was not like it is today on Saturday and Sunday night, people, you know, present day, they don't, that's kind of hard to believe, right?
Yeah.
But certainly that made a difference, because Pip and Dick said, Blaine, we want to do something that's going to, not only is it going to be something that an incredible parade, but if we could just get people on Sunday night to be here till Monday, and if they're here on Monday morning, they wake up on Monday morning, they're very likely going to stay through Tuesday. And so they were just looking to get a few more nights of folks in hotel rooms and restaurants, in their restaurants.
And so with Bacchus Dinners, it really created the beginning of the big weekend before Mardi Gras. Bacchus, and then along came Endymion and then Orpheus. Prior to that, there were parades, but they were mostly like smaller parades. I think the Crew of Mecca or something. They weren't the big parades. And so it also, I guess, from a hotel perspective, it created like the four-night hotel package at the same time. And so it was really a boom area. And then also they drew in a lot of, you know, the old idea of the people that rode in the floats for like local people. I mean, it brought in a lot of people to ride in those parades. And they were big spenders. You know, they came in and they stayed in the various hotels. And so it was a big thing. I heard a story, and this little many bits and pieces, that your dad, when he first met with Pip Brennan, and he talked about, we want to have this really big parade, and we want to have celebrities, and we want to, you know, go into the convention center or the Rivergate at the time. And he went back to the office, and somebody asked your dad, well, where'd you go? And he said, I just met with Pip Brennan, and he's crazy, okay? He heard all these ideas, and he just kind of put them down. But that was the kind of thing your dad probably just really embraced. I mean, he probably loved doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, like so many things with, you know, in living with my dad and hearing these stories, between talking to Pip, who's still around, and, you know, and of course, Clark and Pip's sons, and these conversations. And yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. You know, they had this idea. And of course, my dad, obviously, yeah, he embraced the idea that these guys wanted to build floats that had never been seen, and wanted to do something that really was going to be totally different and a seismic change to what, you know, what had been done before. And also, of course, you know, the idea with the Rivergate, to go into the building, you know, was my dad's idea, because my dad had, the way that my dad explained it to me was, is he used to do a crew called Montala in Montgomery, Alabama. And these guys would hire him. He would do these mini floats, and he would go up to Montgomery, and these guys would literally, they would do a procession where they would walk into, he said it was almost like really, really crazy. These guys would wear like these white robes. and they wore these white robes, and they went into a cow palace, right? A big giant barn, cow palace.
Yeah. In
Montgomery. And the guy who ran it was I think he was the Coca-Cola bottler in Montgomery. And basically, my dad would go up there, and he said he saw these guys, this procession, come into this giant cow palace, where with floats and these men marching in, and all of the guests were inside. And he said that's where he instantly got the idea, we need to take these parades and bring them into a building. Because one of the more interesting stories, Errol, I think, is when Herman Penn, you remember that name, the guy who was the kind of the father of tourism, that they had brought in from Philadelphia to build the Rivergate for the city.
Yeah, okay.
And Herman Penn was at a meeting of the Rivergate. It was a public meeting. And of course, this is in 1968 or 69, before Blaine was, I guess, Blaine Kern. I mean, he was still Blaine Kern, but he wasn't
a celebrity. He wasn't
he was a float builder. And I guess, my dad was born in 27. So he's a 40-year-old guy. And he's at this meeting, and this guy Penn, they have a model of the Rivergate, and it's all the, you know, it's basically probably maybe the Chamber of Commerce or some public meeting. They're talking about the Rivergate. That's going to be this where meetings are going to happen. And my dad keeps raising his hand in this meeting. He's like, how big are the doors? How tall is the ceiling? How tall is this? What is that? And finally, this guy Penn, who had been hired to come to New Orleans from Philadelphia and had written a book on the meeting business, basically says, "Sir, may I ask who you are?" And my father said, "Well, I'm Blaine Kern. You know, I build floats." He said, "Well, why are you asking all these questions?" He says, "Well, because Mardi Gras parades are going to go in this building." And Mr. Penn goes, "Sir, this building's being built for the meeting business. This is not going to be a place for Mardi Gras parades." And my father said, "Mr. Penn, you might know a lot about the meeting business and the convention business." He says, "I know a lot about New Orleans. Mardi Gras floats will go into this building." And they ended up having to change the size of the doors and to get these floats into the building. They made it where it could accommodate it. And at that time, of course, you had Pip Brennan and Dick and all those guys that were involved in that business, you know, in the tourism business and in the nascent tourism business. They all could influence that. But that was the thing is that they knew what would happen. And frankly, I think that changed everything in my mind in terms of, you know, I remember my dad telling me when Bob Hope came into that building and, you know, he was just like, it's the most down earth, wonderful guy. And my dad said, you know, Bob Hope grabbed me after he got off of the float. And he's like, "Blaine, I've been all over the world. I've seen everything." He says, "Never in my life have I experienced something like what I experienced tonight when that float turned on to Napoleon Avenue, but even better, when the floats came into this building and I saw that sea of people in evening gowns and black tie and the bands and the lights and the floats." He said, it was just magical. So when you have a guy like Bob Hope who's experienced everything, you knew you'd hit on something that was going to be over the top. And of course, that was the same year that Blaine had brought Ed Muniz to the Rivergate for the Bacchus extravaganza. And of course the story, you know, Ed was like sold immediately. And my dad was able to convince Pip and Dick to allow Endymion to have the night before to come into the building. And that, you know, of course Endymion going to the Superdome was monumental. And I don't think, frankly, that party, frankly, in my mind is in terms of the experience is really, you know, still unbelievable every time I see it.
So had they not agreed to enlarge the entries into the Rivergate, Bacchus would have happened, but it would never become what it was. I mean, because it would have just been like another parade. I mean, it really needed that access to the inside event to interest people to ride in it, to have the event. It changed it all.
Yeah, well, even more importantly to understand is that those entrances to that building, if you remember, and you may not remember, but I remember it very well, the entrances to the building, the whole building was basically dock high on the back of it, because it was dock high because trucks were going to pull up and back into it, right, and get their cargo out. So it was all dock high. So they had to build ramps, which was an afterthought to the overall design. They built these ramps that went in. There were two doors that were on the back of the Rivergate, and it was a ramp. And the old international tractors that we had pulling the floats, and of course, that's another story we should talk about as a tractor. But the old international tractors, we would have to get men, the other tractor drivers that had gotten off of their floats, and we'd have to get all of our men, and literally as those floats would try to go up this ramp into the building, we'd have 10 or 20 guys pushing the floats up these ramps. And if the float, we couldn't get it up, we'd have to throw a ladder underneath the back wheel so it wouldn't come, you know, back into on this ramp. It was the craziest thing you ever want to be. We were breaking every OSHA rule that they had before there was OSHA, I guess.
And so by the time the Rivergate predated the convention center, so by the time the convention center came around, everybody knew at the very beginning, we got to have these big gates to have parades going there.
Well, yeah, and of course, if you remember, the first phase of the convention center was built for the World's Fair. And if you remember, my brother Blaine built they had a dark ride in there called the Louisiana Journey, which my brother was part of. But of course, Blaine, my father, and Pip Brennan and Dick, and a lot of those same guys that had started Bacchus were guys that were on the convention center board, right? Okay. And so, yeah, they obviously knew. And look, the thing is, at the end of the day, certainly in hindsight, we could certainly give New Orleans the credit in terms of we're known now for Mardi Gras. I mean, you know, we may be known, we're known for food, we're known for hospitality, we're known for music, but I would say the one thing that we own, and certainly when I was on the Louisiana Tourism Promotion District Board, we did a study. New Orleans owns Mardi Gras, and Mardi Gras and New Orleans are inseparable, right? And I think that that's one of the reasons why we get so much visitorship to New Orleans, is because people have this sense, you know, that when you get to New Orleans, you're going to have this incredible experience. And I think that lends a lot to what the city is the idea that we are Carnival and Mardi Gras.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to throw out a theory to you, okay? And I don't have any validation behind it. This is just Errol's theory, but let me just tell you. You know the story about when the captain of Rex at the time, when they when they hired your dad, who was just kind of a small-time float builder in Algiers, and sent him to Via Reggio to study float building.
Another game changer.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and they had the floats with the moving parts and the all of that, you know. And so it became the New Orleans style big parade was influenced by Via Reggio. Okay. Here's the thing. That would have been like in the 50s, like probably 59, 60, something like that, or maybe a little bit earlier.
So Darwin sent Blaine. Blaine went in the early 50s.
Yeah.
It was right after, it coincided at a time, I get to give the timing because I know the story so well and I've told it so many times. Yeah. Walt Disney was in New Orleans a lot.
Uh-huh.
And my dad had gone out to California because my dad had just built a brief. Yeah. We could figure it out. The year that King Kong, Alep had a King Kong theme.
Yeah.
And my dad built a giant King Kong that went in the municipal auditorium for the ball.
Uh-huh.
And Walt Disney, who was in New Orleans often, asked for my father to recreate it for him, and he put it on his television show and show the wide world of Disney. He had a uh-huh. ship way to park. And then, of course, he invited my dad to California, where he offered my father a job, and my dad came back and went straight to Fenner's office the next after he got back from California. And he said, Captain, he said, you might hear, I don't want you to worry. He said, but I could spend 3 months. I can build 3 months. I can build the Rex parade. I can build the Alep parade in a month. But for the other 7 or 8 months of the year, I'm going to be out in California working for Walt Disney. And Fenner must have been, well, in fact, I know Fenner probably was one of the most, this guy had so much foresight, and frankly, in my mind, certainly one of the greatest influences in Carnival, when I could tell you all the things that I know that he did in helping my father and pushing my dad to do things. But he looked at my dad, and he said, Blaine, he said, that's so wonderful. Wow, Walt Disney. He said, that's incredible. I mean, man, I'm so impressed. He said, so the only thing is, Blaine, you know, I'm a little worried, you know, you could end up being a little fish in a big pond out there in Hollywood. He said, you know, it's really too bad, because I was thinking this year after Mardi Gras, I was thinking that, you know, all of the Merrill Lynch offices in Europe are owned by the old banking families. And those old banking families, who are associates, they also run all the old carnivals. Man, I was thinking about sending you to Via Reggio, Italy, to meet the Carista, the greatest float builders in the world. And I was going to send you to, you know, Nice, in Venice to meet the mass makers, and then you were going to go to, I was sending you to Mans, Frankfurt, and Cologne, and you meet the guys who do the fashing, and then you go to Valencia, Spain, and meet the Fayeros, the greatest artist in paper mache. And so he said, and Blaine, I was going to pay for it, but I could certainly understand why you'd want to go to work for Walt Disney. And of course, Blaine had a decision, you know, go to Europe for free and do everything that he'd want to do, or go to work in California. And of course, the rest was history. And but this guy Fenner, in my mind, probably, and I certainly, from my perspective and from where, certainly influenced my father. But his foresight in terms of understanding, and imagine today if I would go to the captain of any organization and tell them that I need room to put the Alep floats in the Rex Den while I build the Bacchus parade, which I'm going to make the greatest parade that ever had. And you know how Blaine would be.
Yeah.
He's going around town telling everybody that this is going to be the best parade that ever was. And of course, it upset a lot of people and aggravated a lot of people and probably aggravated a lot of Rex members. But Darwin Finner knew that this was good for Carnival and good for Mardi Gras. The same way he knew when he told Blaine, you get with Zulu and make sure Zulu has a route. You know, has a route that we know with times and where is it going to go? And you support them to make sure, because he knew that if Mardi Gras was going to survive, that it was very important that Black Mardi Gras survive in New Orleans and grow. And listen, I mean, all of the cities around the country that had carnivals, most of them died because they didn't do what happened in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, Mardi Gras democratized and everybody feels like they own Mardi Gras and are part of Mardi Gras here. I mean, it belongs to the people as much as it belongs to any crew or anybody. So I think that was the in my mind, that's the key element to the whole thing was Darwin Finner had the foresight to know that everybody had to have a piece of this thing. And he was above worrying about his own particular little part. Because Rex, look, nobody can ever take away what Rex brought to and has given Carnival and what it represents. But certainly, we can say that Endymion and Bacchus and Orpheus and all of these other organizations that have come along, Hermes at its time, each or one of these that has elevated what we do. And look, the stuff that we're doing now, Errol, I mean, even my dad, he told my son Fitz before he passed, he grabbed my son and you know, my dad was a dreamer. He said, Fitz, what you and your dad are going to do with this business, you can't even, he said, you can't even dream to what's going to happen. I'm so excited for you. And he, another thing he told me during COVID, because I told him, I said, Dad, things aren't good. I mean, things are really bad. He said, son, don't you worry about this. We'll get past this. And he's like, don't ever bet against New Orleans. And New Orleans is, I mean, we are an incredible city, an incredible entity. I mean, I think, you know, and Carnival is such a big part of that. But going back to it, I mean, I think that Darwin Finner was just an incredible influence on Blaine. And from that point on, Blaine made sure that that's what he would do in Carnival was to make sure we got as many new crews and many new things. And where people might see a competition, in his mind, it was only things that were raising the bar. Mm-hmm. I can certainly tell you, had Orpheus not come along and built the Leviathan, right? The Leviathan changed everything in our business, because once the Leviathan was built, it set a standard. And the next thing you know, Ed Nunes didn't want a Leviathan. He wanted something three times better, right?
Yeah.
And of course, then everybody, and that's the great thing about Carnival in my mind, is that all these guys are competing to make it better all the time. And obviously there's a cycle of it, but I think Carnival does continue to get better. I really do. And certainly in the stuff that we produce, the profit is getting better.
I remember one time visiting your dad, and I think he won the show at Tool. It was the beginnings of the robot thing, which I want to talk about. But Sonny Borre from Orpheus was there. So I was with your dad and Sonny Borre. And I realized these are the same person, these two guys, okay? They're both P.T. Barnum, okay? I mean, they're both big talkers with big ideas. And I thought all you needed was Ed Muniz in the crowd, you know? But that's what you needed. You need that kind of guy, especially with Mardi Gras. Anyway, the point I wanted to make is that the Rex organization in the 50s sent your dad to Via Reggio to learn the European techniques. What I've noticed is that, you know, Rex started in 1872. Now, when something's in Italy, you think it's probably ancient, like 1400s. Nope. Via Reggio started in 1873, the year after. So yep. Rex is a year older. And I think what might have happened is that the people in Via Reggio in Italy heard about what was going on in New Orleans. And over the next few years, and especially with New Orleans being a port, you know, people boats going back and forth. And I would think that there were people from Via Reggio who were coming to New Orleans at that time and looking at Mardi Gras. And I think they influenced each other. Okay.
Well, certainly I agree with that, Errol, because if you look at those dates, you're right. But you have to remember this, right? And this is the interesting thing, because it's even the same with in Valencia, Spain.
Uh-huh.
The same timing on Las Fallas. and you go to some of these other, these celebrations existed, but the floats, the float processions didn't. But as my father, and my father loved, he loved this analogy. It was one of his favorite analogies because he would love to, you know, compare himself to a genius. Was he's like, you know, son, Leonardo da Vinci was a float builder, you know, and Leonardo da Vinci did build floats. I mean, he designed and built floats for processions. So I think the Italians have been doing it for quite a long time. They had this incredible, and of course, and I even see it now because we do business, you know, we still would do some things with the guys and the Italians. I've got people from Valencia, Spain, that if you look at, well, behind me in my office here, I've got this guy, Salvador Gimeno, who I learned from, just like my father went, my dad sent me as a young man to Spain to work with the Falleros, which were really these incredible artists. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's happened is, and of course that was during the World's Fair, I think what's happened is that you're right. There was an influence of what happened here in New Orleans. You look at Gasparilla, which is the pirate invasion down in Tampa, was certainly influenced by Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And I think that Mardi Gras in New Orleans and Carnival here certainly has influenced a lot of things all over. And then vice versa, as we went, as my dad went to these other places to learn these techniques and these ideas and brought them back, because Mr. Fenner knew that it would be good to bring in all these different practices and ideas, you know, the heraldry of the you know, the ducal decorations and the bronze coins that we had made in Germany by B.H. Meyers Nutzbragen, and all these different things, the influences from Valencia and the processes that now that we use. And, you know, when I got into the business, my dad was Mr. Mardi Gras. And he basically, I made the decision to go into the, start working for the theme parks and people like that. Because frankly, when Mr. Mardi Gras is in the room, that's pretty much the only guy you know that was in the room when he's in the room, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of room for anybody else. But he was always telling myself and my brother Blaine, you know, do the balls, Barry, you focus on the props and do this. He had that, and we did that. But I would say that we went out and I learned all of these things, and by doing work in Las Vegas and Orlando for Universal Studios, and now we've got parades in Beijing and Shanghai and Japan and all over the in Korea. We learn these techniques, and all of this stuff comes back to New Orleans. At the same time, these guys are emulating what we do here in New Orleans. It just so happens that in a lot of these cases, this parade that we just built in Beijing, for example, for Universal Studios, it's the most expensive parade, probably. I'm pretty sure there maybe has never been a parade more expensive ever on Earth built. I mean, we spent just on the engineering and design documents millions of dollars just designing it for a parade. So I think that all of these things have influenced each other. And I think Via Reggio is certainly incredible influence. And really, I think they're still the best float builders in the world between you and me. The guys in Via Reggio, because all they do is build 10. They build 10 big floats and 10 little floats a year. Uh-huh. You know, we build 600 or 700 floats. I would love to, if I only had 10 floats to build a year. But of course, we have streetcar lines and trees that we have to worry about. But I can tell you, I can show you some of the things that we've built recently for some of our clients in other places. And it really is spectacular what can be done and what New Orleans has influenced.
And Via Reggio just has like a big boulevard that they put them down through.
Yeah. Right down, it's on the Corniche. It goes right down along the ocean front. Yeah. And it's a straight shot. They come out of there, you know, they have a den. And see, their Mardi Gras, different than ours, is it's funded by a lottery, right? Mm. And they have the Carista, which are the guys that run it. So they have the Carista. And it basically, there's 10, there might be 5 or 10 artists that do everything. And everybody gets paid the same. Now, I would have a real problem if I was getting paid the same as the next guy and I'm doing a 10-time better job. Uh-huh. But they all get paid. They have a little bit socialistic in that basically a big float is X amount of dollars and everybody gets paid the same, whether they're really good or really bad at it. So I wouldn't be too happy about that. That's the one thing I'm glad we haven't adopted from Via Reggio.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about some of the modern float building technology. I know one thing y'all are very proud of is the robot that you had, the robotic system. Was that something that was developed for you, or the or did something like that exist already?
Well, so it was interesting. So I did, again, you know, a big part of our, obviously, everybody in New Orleans knows us for what we do here in town is Mardi Gras and Mardi Gras World. A really big part of our business is work outside of New Orleans for theme parks, casinos, museums, all around the world. And so I had seen in Shanghai, Disney built a theme park. And I guess it's almost 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, that they built it. And the Black Pearl in, so, and that's the other thing about, I want to mention about Disney for the people listening to this. The only city represented in Disney theme parks, and every single Disney theme park in the world has a New Orleans square. It's the only city that's represented in Disney.
That's quite an honor.
He loved New Orleans, and it's outside, right outside of Pirates of the Caribbean, and you go into New Orleans Square. So, but getting back to this robot, I for the Shanghai Disney, the Black Pearl ship in Pirates of the Caribbean, they built two 60-meter, basically 200-foot-long ships, and they set up two of these robots on a rail to basically, they built 3D models, and I saw that process. And when I saw that process, I said to myself, man, I would love to have something like that, right? And of course, I just thought it was pie in the sky. And long story short, I did a little digging into it. And some of the guys that work here with me, some of the sculptors dug into it a little bit. And there was a company here in the United States that was basically taking these same robots that are used in the automobile manufacturing and in the manufacturing business all over the world. They're called KUKA. And it's really an international machine. It's a German machine. I think it has like maybe an Italian or Japanese, you know, motor. It's very interesting. But these, you see them in automobile manufacturers and all the theme parks now, basically running the operating these rides. But this machine was super expensive. And so when I heard how much it was, which it was well in into the seven figures, I said, well, man, that's a lot of sculptors. I can't afford it. After talking to the guy who had developed the ones in Shanghai. So I hung up the phone, and about 3 weeks later, the guy called me up and he said, hey, Mr. Kern, I want to talk to you about the robot, KUKA robot. And I said, man, I said, that's great. He said, there's one that MIT has that is in a, MIT has it in one of their departments, but they basically don't want to lease the building that it's in anymore. Don't really know the situation, but basically, you can have this, you know, we can get you this robot and it's on a rail. I said, man, that's wonderful. I said, but I still can't afford it. But thank you so much. He said, no, Mr. Kern, wait a minute. He goes, I can sell this thing to you and have it installed for about 20 to 25 cents on a dollar of what the machine costs. Well, between you and me, Errol, the 25 cents on a dollar was still expensive.
Uh-huh.
But I made the decision to do it, and it's one of the best decisions we ever made, and certainly not from a Mardi Gras perspective, but from the perspective of when we do work for Chick-fil-A, or you do work for Disney or Universal, you're working with, you know, IP that's from DreamWorks or from Disney or even, you know, Chick-fil-A or even Cane's. You do a 3D model and you build that model and your customer approves that model based upon their style guide. So once that's approved and you press, you know, after the, after it's been modeled on the machine, it's going to give you exactly that. And then what you do is you take an artist, you have a regular artist at the end of it, finish it off to make it, because frankly, it's very hard to design a model on them, even with today's techniques. I mean, it's getting better and better every day. Don't misunderstand me. But it's hard for things to not look like they came out of a machine. So you always have to give it to an artist at the end and let that artist take it and make it, give it the hand feel. And what it's allowed us to do is it's allowed us to manufacture a lot more things a lot faster. And to put things in perspective, I'll just tell you, we last year, in the last, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks, because we didn't have the chassis because they were back ordered and we didn't have tires, we built 16 floats from the ground up in basically the last month and a half of before Carnival. And so it just gives us the ability to manufacture and to build stuff really efficiently. And it's all about production in this business, because you sell time. You have a finite amount of time, and that's what we do. We're selling our time. So the more stuff that we can do, it's just the more money that we can make, and we can continue to get better machines, better people. And that was always my dad's thing. He wanted to make sure that we had the best artists, the best designers, Manuel Ponce, the best guys doing this. And now I've got Manuel Ponce, who's probably the most prolific designer in the history of Carnival. Manuel is now basically, we've got guys that are training under him, and we have multiple people that are now can do the designs and do the things that we've done. And so that's the other thing, is what is the next generation, right? I mean, what's it's hard to keep people, 30 years ago, it was easy to find people that wanted to be in this business. I will tell you, like anything, it's harder and harder to find people that want to, frankly, sweat and be out in dens and get on ladders and paint floats and do all the things that we do. So we're always looking for new people. And that's the other thing, is, you have to pay the best to get the best.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Wasn't one of the first creations of the robot with Muses, the family of ducks? It was like the mama ducks and then the little ducks.
Yeah.
The robot, yeah.
And so what that was able to do, what we were able to do, and that brings in, that thing brought in multiple things. Number one, we were able to build, so we built the model of the ducks for Stacy Rosenberg to approve. Right. She saw the model. She said yes. Then we actually made maquettes, small models of the ducks. We love that. Let's go for it. Then we were able to actually build the mold. We didn't actually build a positive of the duck. We built a mold of the duck. And basically, we were able to go directly. So basically, the robot was able to make a negative. And so then I had that negative, and then that negative gets waxed, gets its the gel coat, which is the color yellow of the ducks, and then it got the fiberglass inside of it, and then all those pieces are put together. And the guy who did that was a guy named Carlos Grinnell, who's from Valencia, Spain. And his father was the maestro mayor, the head teacher of all these falleros in Valencia, where I learned all the techniques that I learned. And Errol, another thing is that what people do now in the movie industry, and even in Disney and the theme parks, the people that are in our business, they are basically copying the processes that we came up with. Kern Studios were processes that I came up with in the early 90s, right after I did the Euro Disney project. I came back to New Orleans and I got the job to do Luxor in Las Vegas. I'll never forget, my father called me and he said, "Son, you have to come to Las Vegas." And I'm in Paris, just finishing the Euro Disney job. And I'm living in Spain with my wife, Tina, who's pregnant with my first son, Fitz. So this is 31, 32 years ago. And my dad's like, "Son, you need to come to Las Vegas." And I'm like, "Why, Dad?" He said, "Son," he said, "because they're about to build Disneyland with slot machines out here." So what are you talking about? Well, if you remember, MGM had this idea that they were going to build a family entertainment in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. It never did quite come to fruition. But at the same time, riverboat gaming had just been legalized in Louisiana. And my dad, they had come to town and done a convention here on gaming. My dad met some guys, and we ended up going out there, and we got the job for Luxor. And I'll never forget, I got out to Luxor. Was a patch of ground at the end of McCarran Airport on Las Vegas Strip. And I had this work to do, and they had seen all the stuff. I'm showing them the pictures of everything we had just done for Disney in Paris. And they were impressed, obviously, because we were the first company ever allowed to do the Disney IP. And they said, we want you to do all the theming for Luxor. Well, it was in, first of all, in Las Vegas, they work three shifts when they build, when they're doing construction in Las Vegas, three 8-hour shifts. So they will build a whole casino in 6 months because they figure every day the casino's not open is money they're not making, right?
Yeah.
So they build it very quickly, but which that meant that I had to build everything I had to do had to be done in 6 months. So I agreed to do all this work and basically had a contract to do more work than we had ever done in a 10-year period in 6 months. And so I had to come up with a way to do it. And on my way back from Las Vegas, I went to St. Louis and I met this guy who had a machine. It was a urethane, sprayed urethane. It's basically the same material that your car bumpers are made out of and your dashboards, your ice chest. He had a process and I basically went and saw his process. I bought the machines. I brought them to New Orleans. I brought guys into town. I brought his guys from St. Louis to train our people. And we basically came up with a method that we could, a sculptor could sculpt something, but then I could make a mold of it and make pieces in the same day. Now, you have to remember, I had just learned how to do this in Spain, where you would make a plaster mold, and then you'd make a fiberglass piece, but it would take you a day or two to make a plaster mold, and then it would take, you could only get one piece a day out of a fiberglass out of the mold. Well, I basically took that process and basically made it 20 times faster. And once I did that, unfortunately, I never paid much attention to Tulane when I was at school because Blaine didn't go to college. And the only thing he ever asked me about Tulane is how it was. And I said, Dad, it was great. I had a wonderful, I'm having a wonderful time at Tulane. I didn't really pay attention. If I had basically either copyrighted or licensed the process we came up with, because now everybody in the industry now copies that process that I came up with my guys to do the jobs in Las Vegas. And we had a run in Las Vegas. We were out there for about 10 years. We built the, you know, the giant Statue of Liberty at New York, the giant M&M's, four-story tall, all that crazy stuff that we did. And we did it because we had a process that was just really, it was a game changer for the whole industry. And now stuff gets built very quickly. And we still do the same process. It really is amazing, to be honest with you.
Just a sentimental thing. Isn't the robot named Pixie?
Yes.
Okay.
Pixie, we all know Pixie Nakan, who was Blaine's right hand. And Pixie was kind of like a mom and a sister to me at the same time. Besides, you know, she was basically the glue that held the company together. You know, my dad was, I guess, to a certain extent, you know, like me, although, I mean, not, you know, we're not exactly the same in terms of processes, but certainly my dad was more focused on getting things sold, right, and coming up with ideas. And I was always into getting things sold and then building it and how do you do it and make it, because I had the time to do that and I learned that. And then, of course, now I have my son, who is an incredible manager. So between him as the president of the company and me still understanding the processes and being able to recognize what we can use and what we can implement. And then I have my younger son, Patrick, who's now coming into the business and he's basically out in the field. He was, you know, taking stuff off of the Harris Casino today, artwork, and we're getting ready to do new stuff. I mean, all of these things, it takes all these different disciplines to make the perfect blend. But I will tell you, we're a better company today because, frankly, not only do we have the discipline that I learned from my father, but I have Pixie and my son Fitz in terms of a very good manager that's here working with us. And, you know, and he's put together his own team and brought in people that work with us. Because, frankly, I'm 61. I'm getting older. And I'm like, man, you need to bring in young guys and people that want to do this. And to me, that's probably the biggest challenge that we have is keeping people interested in wanting to do this kind of thing. You know, it really is. It is a dying art, truthfully. Yeah.
Is paper mache still used at all in flocculi?
Every day. So the flowers are still made out of paper. We still do some papering of props. We will build, we will sculpt a foam prop, whether it's out of the robot or, you know, we have, besides, we have four sculptors on staff just here in New Orleans. We have another probably 20 sculptors on staff in the Philippines because we're doing work all over Asia and all over the world. You know, you still have to have sculptors. And then also besides sculptors, we have the Kuka robot and we have a robot in the Philippines. So we have those things help get the production going. But yeah, it's the process of the way that we do this is, you know, is continually, you know, to get better, I see.
I didn't know you had two robots. I didn't realize you had a robot in the Philippines. Man, you're really an international guy. Huh? That's incredible.
Well, you know, so what happened was is when we were doing the job in Beijing and you're doing stuff in Asia, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be doing stuff in New Orleans. And very frankly, Errol, there's not enough people. We don't have enough people in New Orleans to do a job like we're doing in these theme parks. I could if I wasn't doing 700 floats a year, right? But the point is that, listen, New Orleans, this is the one thing I'll tell you. New Orleans is so important to me in terms of just, we're doing a Sugar Bowl parade day after tomorrow. Yeah. I don't need to do a sugar. I mean, we really don't need to do a Sugar Bowl parade, but you know what? The Sugar Bowl, we're competing against the Rose Bowl, the Fiesta Bowl, Peach Bowl. We're competing against Orange Bowl and these other cities, other places that have a lot more money than us. And frankly, I think it's part of my job to make sure that we put on a show at Sugar Bowl that supersedes what these other cities are doing. And I think we do. The fan experience has been over the top. We just did it out in Phoenix, Arizona for the Fiesta Bowl parade for them as well. My point is that I think that you know, that New Orleans is the base for all this stuff. And frankly, I feel like the reason why people like doing business with our company is not only because we do a great job at what we do, it's also the legacy and the history of what we do here in New Orleans. When I was out in Las Vegas as a young man, all of the guys that were competing with me, because what happened at the same time I got into this business was about the same time CGI, computer graphics, was coming into the television and film world. So all of those guys that built sets in California and Hollywood were all of a sudden in my business, right? Because they didn't have, there wasn't that much work for the movies because they could do a lot of those things on computers. So all of a sudden I'm competing with all these other people that were in basically in the same business that we were, that we were in. And so what ended up happening was that, you know, there was a real demand in terms of how we could compete and being better and always doing things a little bit better than what the other guys were doing. And so that's kind of kept us on our toes, so to speak.
Okay. Barry, unfortunately, we only have a few minutes left. I just want to ask you a couple of quick questions. As I look at Carnival, one thing that kind of concerns me is, will there be an issue with police manpower? You know, fewer people going to police work. Does the city need a new plan in terms of developing security for the parades? Or, you know, last year they had to cut down some of the routes because there's not enough police.
Well, look, I mean, last year we were able to go back to some of the ones that we had done before. I think the only one that really is greatly affected now, to a great extent, is Tote. And, you know, which I think is a shame, but at the same time, almost understandable, since it's kind of the only one that basically is going on that route. Now, you say that that's also the same with Endymion. The difference with Endymion is that Endymion, in my mind, is such a big parade. Frankly, Endymion doesn't really work on St. Charles Avenue. It's frankly too large.
Yeah, sure.
It's too big. It really is way too big to be on St. Charles. That's number one. Number two, Endymion spends a lot of money, six figures, to help supplement the police on their parade route in the beginning of the parade. In fact, you know, they bring it in and they work very closely. I think we're in better shape today than we were just a couple of years ago relative to the police, even though we still have a diminishing numbers. But we've got Andrew Palumbo is basically running that, who had a lot of history of running the parades for the NOPD. He's back in charge. He's in charge of that. And frankly, he brings to it institutional experience, having done it pretty much for many, many, many years. And so I think that we're actually in really good shape. We have a great relationship with him. The new police chief is spectacular. I think she's from Memphis, so she understands a city like New Orleans. And frankly, she told me that she was involved as a kid in the Cotton Carnival, so she understands the social and the economic aspects of a festival and an event like that in a city like New Orleans, having done it in Memphis. So she has a lot of respect for the process of what we're doing for Mardi Gras. And then we also have a great relationship with the criminal sheriff. Sheriff Hudson is really helping us a lot as well. So I think we're going to be fine. I mean, look, yes, it is an issue, but I think that with the new governor and the mayor and everybody here is on the same page, I think that people understand how important Carnival is. So I think that we will always have that. We'll have the people that we need, because frankly, the trade-off is not so good, Errol. I mean, Mardi Gras pumps a lot of money. In fact, I haven't seen. Have you seen the new economic?
No, I haven't. I don't think it's out yet. Yeah,
I don't think it is either. But I can certainly tell you that Mardi Gras is still an industry within itself.
Well, Mark, I thought this has been fascinating. And what I get out of this interview, I knew this, but now I really appreciate it, is how something as simple as our early Mardi Gras, you know, a few people putting parades, how it's evolved into an international industry and the influence that it's had. You know, and certainly the Kern family has been the key to all that. And so it's a very encouraging story.
Well, it's a great story. As we sit here, I'll tell you, I just got back and I'm sending my guys down to Orlando. You know, the thing we do at Universal Studios down there, they literally turn their whole theme park into New Orleans. Everything is purple, green, and gold. They build a French Quarter. They've got props all over the place, and they have a parade every night. Yeah. And they're throwing the cheapest bead that you can buy, and the people go crazy, and it's the longest-running show in the history of Universal Studios, almost 30 years. And the guest satisfaction ratings are off the chart. And I think that everybody that goes to that says, man, you know what? I want to go see the real thing in New Orleans.
I hope so. I hope they think that. Yeah. I hope they don't think, well, this is what Mardi Gras is like, and I don't need to see it anymore.
Well, I will tell you, it's pretty close to a Mardi Gras experience, except it's in a theme park, and you don't have to worry about maybe some of the, you don't get a parking ticket when you park your car to go walk to the parade route. It is a controlled environment, but it's pretty darn close to the real experience, because you literally have people throwing beads. Yeah. And the kids and the people, no matter where they're from, that's what always amazes me. People that have never been to a parade will immediately acclimate to a New Orleans parade condition, and their hands are in the air and they're going crazy screaming. And I think that's what makes Mardi Gras different than every other carnival anywhere else in the world, is the interaction of people on the floats interacting with the people in the crowd, and that the spectators, there are no spectators in New Orleans, it's just participants of Mardi Gras, right?
Last question. Do you, at the peak of the season, do you ever get to enjoy Mardi Gras just as a fan, not as a business guy? I mean, is there a point where you can kick back and, you know, have a hot dog and a beer or some red beans and just enjoy it, or is it just working until it's over?
So, well, look, I mean, you know, obviously, I can get on a tractor. I can actually, you know, I know how to drive the tractors. I know how to move the floats. I know how to move the floor. I pretty much can do anything that needs to be done. Uh-huh. The good news is that I seldom have to do those things, but I'm always on call to make it happen. I kind of enjoy, sometimes I'll stop at the Advocate and I'll watch Ferret go by, you know, watch them. And then as well, last year I had a group of, or the year before last, I had a group of YPO and CEO, these guys in town on a kind of like a junket where they would ride in Orpheus and experience Mardi Gras for the weekend. And they were all from Texas. And I was with with a guy from Texas who is from Houston. And he and I sat there and we watched the Rex parade together. The funny thing about it was, is he had ridden in Orpheus the night before. And it just so happened, this was a couple of years ago when we had the big Jester float, when they used it in Rex. And so we got to sit there and watch the parade together. Unfortunately, we don't build the Rex parade anymore. So it wasn't quite as enjoyable as it maybe could have been for me. But I did watch, because I watched Zulu at Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
I watch it make its turn. And then once I know everything's going and moving, then I walked up a couple of blocks and I watched Rex with these group of people that were our guests from out of town. And I really did enjoy watching the parade. And of course, look, it was a beautiful day. And all I can hope and pray for is that we have great weather this year for this early carnival that we have. But yeah, I do get to enjoy it. But truthfully, it is a job, but truthfully, it's not really a job. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, right? I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. I'm in a job that frankly, everybody loves. I think the only time people don't really love what we do is when you're stuck behind the floats and we're moving them through town. But other than that, and I think even most New Orleanians are used to that. So I think I really do have the best job in the world, because I'm doing something that really does bring a lot of happiness to people in New Orleans and frankly all over the world now.
Yeah. I remember the woman with Emma Stroud, was that her name, for many years, was the captain.
Irma Stroud.
She was the captain of Iris.
Yep.
And she told me that the day after the parade, they parade on that Saturday before Mardi Gras. She always went to Las Vegas. Okay, she was out of there that Sunday, and she needed the recovery. But anyway, hey, look, this has been an education. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Errol, and really thank you and your wife for what you guys do to kind of continue teaching people and giving them information on what, I was telling a story earlier today to a guy, just stories about my dad, and it's almost like I feel like I need to get an oral history of a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Get down, because there's so many incredible stories, and frankly today talking about Darwin Fenner gives me great pleasure, because in my mind, Blaine gets a lot of credit, but had there not been Darwin Fenner and him being frankly kind of a mentor to Blaine and giving him basically a roadmap on what he could do to make Carnival better, I think is just a great story in itself.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Bye-bye. As always, if anybody has any questions or comments, just send me an email, errol@mynewOrleans.com. And for the subject line, put Mardi Gras podcast, so I'll know not to delete you.